From KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Al Capp created the comic strip Little Abner and was a prominent American social critic and humorist. He's also the subject of a fascinating new biography by Dennis Kitchen and Michael Schumacher. And From the Bookshelf is happy to welcome both authors to our show this week. Dennis Kitchen, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Gary.
And Michael Schumacher, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks much. Good to be on.
Dennis Kitchen, in addition to being an artist and a historian of comic art, you've been kind of a purveyor of Al Capp's work for many years, reprinting his Little Abner strips in collections. And Michael Schumacher, you've written about iconoclasts like Phil Oakes and Allen Ginsberg. So how did you two come together on this project?
Huh. Dennis here. Well, to start out, we're both cheeseheads, meaning we're from Wisconsin. So there was that physical proximity.
Uh-huh.
But we actually came together on this after I had moved east, and we just found that Al Capp was a common fascination for us.
This is Mike, and the connection was kind of strange because Dennis and I had run into each other here and there over the years, usually at booksellers conventions. And when I was working on my biography of Will Eisner, the comics artist, Dennis, of course, represents Will Eisner's work, and he knows a great deal about him. He's published a lot of it through Kitchen Sink Press. So we connected on like a professional basis where I was interviewing Dennis for the book. And it, as Dennis pointed out, we discovered we both had a big fascination with Al Capp. And when the Eisner book was completed, we got together on this project.
Well, you know, I enjoyed the Eisner book a lot. And I think Will Eisner was just a wonderful, sweet guy. But you couldn't exactly say the same thing about Al Capp.
No, you couldn't. They were probably studies in extremes.
I think they were both driven, though, don't you, Dennis?
What's that?
They were both driven, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, and both genius cartoonists. But Will was much more saintly. Not that any of us are perfect,
yes.
But Al certainly had a dark side.
You know,
it was a lot easier, I will admit, working on the Will Eisner biography than it was the Al Capp biography.
Why was that?
You know, for his flaws, and everybody I've written about has had flaws, you didn't find yourself dealing with the sort of contradictory nature that you had with Al Capp. He could be a very gentle, decent person. He could be vile. he was a very complex person. And there's nothing wrong with writing about a complex person. But when you find yourself at odds all the time, every time you think you had something figured out, you know, something would happen that would change your mind. And it was difficult. And Capp himself didn't help things. I'm sure Dennis would be happy to weigh in on this, in the respect that he couldn't tell the truth. He was almost a pathological liar. And so we were all the time having to check what he would write or what he would tell interviewers and such to see whether or not it was true or not. And so often it just was not. So it made it very, very difficult from a biographer's standpoint because you were always trying to corroborate what the man was saying in his own purported autobiography.
Right.
So he lied a lot.
Let's just say he liked to embellish. You know, he would say things for the purpose of the story. He was, first and foremost, a great storyteller.
Right.
And, unfortunately, the storytelling also led to some of the stories that he told about his own life that weren't necessarily true, but they were great stories. He wrote two different, two different autobiographies. And when he told the story, he would make up an anecdote as he went along. Now, probably the one that was the most difficult for Dennis and I, or one of the most difficult, was his relationship with Ham Fisher, the cartoonist, the creator of Joe Palooka. Capp worked for him when he was very young, and then he went on to do his own thing, and he and Ham Fisher had an extremely acrimonious feud that became very public, and it was very, very ugly. And Camp, even in detailing how he met Ham Fisher, had four or five different stories that he told about how this happened.
Right.
You know, it had to have happened in one way, but you know, he could never even agree with himself on how this happened. How he lost his leg. His father thought he probably was just being careless and tripped into the path of a trolley car. Well, Cap makes it much more glamorous. He was on the back of an ice wagon, and this happened, and that happened. Well, what was it? You know, even his details sometimes were a little different depending on the telling.
We think what the reason probably behind this was he realized early on that the more interesting he could make a story, the more rapt his reader's attention would be. And so as the years went on, he became masterful at it. And that's why he was a regular on a lot of the TV talk shows like Johnny Carson. He may have been one of the guests who had been on the most over the years until he offended Carson and was summarily no longer welcome. But he was fascinating. No question.
We're talking with Dennis Kitchen and Michael Schumacher, and their new book is called Al Capp, A Life to the Contrary. Let's talk a little bit about Little Abner, the greatest of Al Capp's creations, and one of the longest-running comic strips, I believe, in history, and also one of the most unique comic strips in that it was not an adventure strip, but it was not a humor strip in the sense that it continued, you know, in a soap opera-like fashion from day to day. Sometimes the stories would go on for 6 months or 8 months.
Sometimes, yes, and it actually started out more as an adventure strip, but then it evolved into what we could generally say was satirical, certainly humorous, and some of them would last a long, long time. He had adventures, I think, at one point lasted a year with a lot of digressions. But back in his day, there weren't the same kind of rules you had for today's newspaper strips. Right now, everybody has so many distractions and so many forms of entertainment that our attention span is very short. But when he was at the peak of his powers, you have to remember he had very little competition, you know, mainly radio. And so he could take a story and stretch it and stretch it and torture a reader. And no one was better at torturing a reader with cliffhangers than Al Capp. On a Saturday, you could be absolutely sure that he'd leave the strip hanging so that you couldn't wait until Monday. The Sunday adventure was always a separate continuity. And there, too, sometimes they would be a one-shot. Sometimes they would go on for weeks and weeks.
How did he keep the two continuities straight? I wonder how any cartoonist, Milton...
Well, they had to, because that was an economic factor. Some newspapers could only afford to subscribe to a daily. It costs more to get the Sunday. So you could never assume that the same reader got it 7 days in a row. Especially, keep in mind, the big city papers had a color comic section Sunday. But if you lived in a smaller town, your daily paper couldn't afford a Sunday comic section.
You remember, Dennis, in Milwaukee, there was a sort of an adventure strip called Mark Trail. And they did the same thing with him. The Sunday continuities were different than the daily continuities. He'd do the same thing, the creator of that comic strip. He'd leave you hanging on a Saturday, and it was something, you know. You couldn't wait for the paper to show up on Monday so you could see what had happened. Cap was a genius at this. He really was an incredible storyteller. And as Dennis pointed out, it did start out more as an adventure strip, but he wanted humor. And then when he found out he could get a laugh, Cap loved to entertain. If people didn't laugh at his own jokes, he'd laugh at his own jokes. He loved telling jokes. So Little Abner became a perfect for him to do this continuity, yet at the same time comment, you know, make sort of social comment on everything going on around him. So it was a pretty interesting thing to try, as you said. But he had assistants that he worked with, too. And they were always working on the story, so I don't think it ever got too far from his attention. He knew where they were going.
And when did the strip sort of become a political strip, I guess? we would say. That is, it reflected what was happening in politics.
That happened in the 60s when the students started protesting and Cap was personally offended. And he couldn't contain his attitude toward the anti-war movement. And so he began making fun of the hippies, the protesters, anybody associated with them. And when he began doing that, initially, you know, with some success, but he really couldn't contain his personal feelings, and they stopped being humorous. They started being bitter. The last, decade plus of his professional career were really kind of sad. It deteriorated both in an aesthetic sense, because his best assistants retired, and he didn't replace them with the best. And mainly, the humor got tired and repetitive and just overtly political in a way that began to lose a lot of readers, certainly the younger ones.
In the beginning, it was social commentary. And there's a big difference between the social commentary and political commentary. And he just wasn't very good at political commentary within the context of Lil Abner. Social commentary was beautiful. He did a wonderful job with it. Because having this hillbilly family dealing with the quote-unquote civilized world, whether he'd have Lil Abner in New York, which he did quite often, and that was always hilarious, because here was this hillbilly that didn't have a clue. You know, amongst the, like I said, the civilized people, it gave Cap an opportunity. When it just became a political thing, when he was dealing with the campus unrest and that, it quit being funny. It became mean-spirited. And I think people saw through that, and they're going, what happened to this guy that made me laugh so many times in the past? This isn't funny. It's nasty.
Well, the storyline that you guys talk about in the book, where there was a group of hippies, and I can't remember their acronym.
Swine.
What did that stand for?
Students wildly indignant about nearly everything.
And the swine end up in charge of the world because there's a plague that attacks everyone who has recently showered.
Yes.
Right.
And that was the thing. Cap was always better than that. In other words, these were cheap shots that you didn't have to be all that bright to do. I think people kind of lost their patience with him on that. He was always better when his humor was, well, first of all, funny, but it had an edge to it. This lost all of his edge. It was just kind of sloppy to me.
I think his last shining moment during that period was when he attacked Joan Baez.
Absolutely.
He had a character in the strip he called Joni Phony. She was a protest singer, and she had flies buzzing around her head, which meant she never showered. She had no talent, and she was hideous-looking. And when she began appearing in the strip, newspaper reporters caught up with her at one of her concerts, and they said, what do you think of what Al Capp's doing to you? And, of course, she was indignant, and she unfortunately mentioned she was going to be contacting her lawyer. So then they went to Cap, who was waiting for this moment. He had prepared. and he said, well, first of all, gentlemen, the woman in my strip is hideous looking and has no talent and smells, so I'm surprised Miss Baez finds any similarity between herself and my character. And after he got the cheap laugh, then he said, but really, he said, why is she allowed to protest, but I'm not? And that really got to the core of it. Because as a satirist, I think he saw himself as a professional protester. And for years, you know, his indignation, as Mike said, was more social commentary. But then it got personal. It got personal in a way that it hadn't been for the previous 30-some years.
I don't think the world was ready to allow Al Capp to change. In other words, it was one thing if he was attacking the conservatives, but when he had started attacking the liberals, and it wasn't in fashion, he really took a beating for it. Now, in his defense, he certainly was well within his rights to attack the liberals. They certainly left themselves open to satire. And his satire of Joan Baez certainly wasn't any more, you know, off center or off course than his satires of, say, Frank Sinatra. But
Elvis Presley, too.
Or Elvis, yeah. I mean, but there was a difference here because the liberal readers didn't have a sense of humor about this.
So
sometimes he was legitimately funny, but, you know, nobody was going to give him that.
So you think Republicans have a better sense of humor than Democrats about that kind of thing?
Oh, I'm not going on record with that. But, I will say this. They had the Democrats or the liberals. I just prefer to call them liberals rather than just Democrats.
Yeah.
But they didn't like being the object of ridicule. Nobody does.
Right.
But for some reason, everybody was so, you remember, maybe you don't, but in the 60s, everybody was so earnest about everything.
Yeah.
And now here's a guy who's thumbing his nose at them, and they didn't take well to that. And, you know, if he had been funny more often, he would have been, you know, no different than he was when he was satirizing, you know, the conservatives during the Roosevelt era.
We're talking with Dennis Kitchen and Michael Schumacher. Their new book is called Al Capp, A Life to the Contrary. When I was hearing this story of Al Capp, I was thinking, you know, he and John Lennon are a lot alike. They ought to get along really well. And then there's a famous moment in which they actually do confront each other, and neither of them are particularly come out pretty. They don't fare well, either of them, in that particular thing.
You're absolutely right. I don't know. I mean, everybody always says that Lennon acquitted himself. I didn't think he looked all that. He really let Cap get under his skin. Now, granted, I mean, when he was saying xenophobic remarks about Yoko Ono, I could see this is his wife that this guy is ridiculing in front of, you know, all the press and everybody that was there. And it wasn't that he disagreed with Yoko. It was a matter of he was making fun of her because she was Asian. And Lennon wasn't going to stand for that. But Lennon was better than this. He, you know, at his best, John Lennon was, you know, as acerbic and as, you know, lethal as Cap was. And Cap, on the other hand, made a fool out of himself in there at times. At times, he made perfect sense. You know, when he called Lennon on the fact, well, you write your songs for money, just like I make my, you know, comics for money. Well, of course they did. And Lennon was well aware of that. But Lennon didn't want to be stood up like that or shown up like that in front of an audience.
Yeah, right. No, it's people can see that. I'm sure it's on YouTube and it's in the movie Imagine.
Sure. Funny little sidebar to that is also at the Montreal Bed-In was Timothy Leary, and he and Cap left together and flew back together to Boston and got along quite well. So it's another little incongruity that then, you know, right-wing acerbic guy like Cap getting along with the uber-hippie Timothy Leary. But he was like
that. I don't think anybody hated Leary, did they?
Well, I guess he was, yeah, he was an easygoing kind of guy, but still an odd couple.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, you know, you mentioned that Al Capp lost his leg. How, and I would imagine that would play a huge role in his life, but how much of a role did it play and why?
Well, certainly anybody, you know, who has to overcome a handicap, they have to work a little harder. He made it clear early on that he felt like an outcast with his students. He couldn't participate in sports. He was a 9-year-old boy. When we really looked at it with kind of our amateur psychiatrist hat, you couldn't help but think that that was part of his trouble with women. It was something he had to overcome throughout his life to prove that he was a complete man, and then really overdid it. Of course, we didn't get to that part of his career yet, but there's no question that, for better or worse, it affected his career. He did a lot of good things with it in terms of during World War II, he couldn't serve, but he visited hospitals many, many times and gave pep talks to amputees. He visited children's hospitals where other young kids like him were dealing with the trauma. So this is the good Cap. So one of the odd things we found in a suicide note, though he didn't commit suicide, but he claimed in that note that he had never had a day in his life without pain from the moment he lost his leg. And a lot of that was due to ill-fitting prosthetics that he could have afforded to make comfortable. So there's some kind of a psychological thing there where he allowed himself to be in pain every day without alleviating it. And that's something we can never really answer.
I started to say that I think it's important, too. His personality had already been developed before he lost his leg. His brother in his memoir talked about how disagreeable he was at home before he lost his leg. He had a bad temper, and he was very disagreeable. But after he lost his leg, I agree with Dennis. I mean, that you can't, something like that can't happen to you when it doesn't affect you in one way or the other. One of the most, to me, dramatic moments concerning that particular thing that happened in the book was when Ted Kennedy Jr. Came down with cancer and was going to lose a leg. Without any prompting, Al Capa just he wrote the boy a letter. And it was an incredibly sweet, encouraging letter that really told you as much about Cap as anything. You know, he told, Teddy Jr., you know, this doesn't have to define you. You can beat this thing. He was so encouraging. It moved Ted Kennedy, the senator, a great deal, where he scribbled a little note at the bottom of Teddy Jr.'s letter back to Cap, because they were enemies. You know, there was even talk of Cap running against Ted Kennedy for Senate in Massachusetts. They were enemies. But he couldn't believe that Al Cap had taken the time to do this. I think Cap did it because he knew what was going through that child's mind. And he felt, if I can do something to make this a little easier for him, I'm going to do it.
But you did mention, Dennis, a second ago, that there was a negative side to his relationships with women, let's say.
Yeah. He was for a long time what used to be kindly called a womanizer. But to the degree that term applies, later in his life at least, it got much darker, and he became what today we would call a sexual predator. He wasn't caught until very late in his career, but he was a flagrant attacker of women. And I say attack because that was his modus operandi. He was not terribly subtle. There are even some women who now we would regard as famous, but at the time, early in their career, were attacked by him, including Grace Kelly and Goldie Hawn. Others have talked about clumsier attempts he made, like Edie Adams. But for every celebrity woman, there are countless co-eds and secretaries and women without fame who we know were victims, too. And in doing the research for the book, we saw a number of allegations and partial evidence for things that we just couldn't substantiate enough because they had taken place, you know, decades ago. But there were countless episodes.
We know, going back to the 1940s, as early as the 1940s, there was one particular episode where he'd gotten a private detective involved, and they'd tried to run some kind of a smear campaign and everything. And what universities did in those days is, God help me for saying this out loud, but what the Roman Catholic Church with their priests did, they tried to just, can we just keep this quiet? It's not going to be good for anybody. And it was really, really ugly. There were cases where the case down in Alabama was certainly, it was astonishing to me. Four women in one weekend, he's down there, he attacks four women, and the four women are brought in, and they're essentially told, you know, this isn't going to look real good for you. If this becomes public. So everybody dropped it. If it hadn't been for this coming to of Jack Anderson, you know, some years later, it never would have been known what had happened.
Hmm.
Then all these claims, people started lining up. I could tell you a true story, Dennis, because I told Dennis this story when it first happened, and we've kind of, you know, been amazed by it ever since. I live in a medium-sized town in Wisconsin. I had gone to a grocery store one day, and I was standing in line with a couple of things, you know, in the express line to go through, and the person who was checking me out was somebody I knew, and she said, by the way, what are you working on right now? And I said, and I quote directly, I'm working on a biography of Al Kapp, the creator of Lil Abner. And the person, a woman, a middle-aged woman, standing next to me in line, the one right next to me, says, you know, that son of a bitch tried to rape my roommate in college.
Wow.
I'm going, what are the odds of that happening?
Well, it depends on how many people he tried to rape.
Right. So this is the thing. We don't know, you know, obviously,
yeah.
But
and,
we know there were enough. That,
it's a funny incident, but it's
solid.
Not funny because it just shows that he did get around and he just got away with this for so long. And it was
right.
Another time, and you have to remember when in this era, powerful men especially, and wealthy men as he was, they could buy their way or intimidate anyone. And it took finally one courageous young co-ed in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, to insist that charges be pressed. And it wasn't easy. She had to persist a long time before the district attorney agreed.
Oh, that was just horrible what they put her through. And even then, he got a slap on the wrist. Attempted adultery? That's what he ended up, you know, being found guilty of, was attempted adultery.
But at least that made the headlines, and that was a disgrace. And at that point, combined with the increasing unpopularity from his political views, hundreds of newspapers dropped him. He went from close to 1,000 to 400 and some in a very short period. And that effectively ended his career because he was publicly humiliated. But it still was, as Mike said, a slap on the wrist.
Well, I don't know that Al Kapp is as well remembered today. I don't know that young people are aware of him, although, Dennis Kitchen, you've been doing your part by keeping Lil Abner strips alive. But what would you say about the body of work from an artistic point of view?
Well, I certainly hold him in very high regard. Now we're talking about the artist and not the man. I think that as a cartoonist, he's among the tops, I think, other than the topicality, which always requires some explanation. I think the material's largely timeless, and I think he's up there in the pantheon. The problem is it doesn't hold up for some social reasons, including the fact that the main characters are hillbillies, and these days making fun of anyone, including Appalachians, is frowned upon. And it's a dialect that's hard to...
it's a whole language, isn't it? It's written in an entirely different language.
and especially for a younger reader, you know, we're not used to that kind of humor, which was big, you know, in radio and TV, you know, going back with all the Irish humor, the Amos and Andy, all that stuff. That's not the kind of humor people appreciate anymore. So I think if you read the old work today, with some, you know, annotations where necessary, it holds up very well. It's certainly beautiful. And I think the best of it is timeless.
You know, you talked about the Hillbillies. The Beverly Hillbillies was owed directly to Al Kapp and to Lil Abner, that TV program, which was so huge for so many years. There would be no Doonesbury today if there hadn't been Lil Abner. You go on and on about his influence, everything, the words we use, double whammy. That's an Al Kapp expression. That came from Lil Abner. You know, there was an evolution. Mad Magazine, Harvey Kurtzman, the co-creator of Mad Magazine, was open about his debt to Lil Abner when they did their film satires. You know, you go on and on. There was so many things. Even Saturday Night Live and the skit comedy that you're seeing owes to Lil Abner. Is it direct? No, it evolved. And so while maybe the actual strip itself today might, you know, cause some head scratching, if you look at it historically, it was monumentally important, you know, what he did and what that evolved into, what we take for granted today.
Well, an interesting person, a strange life, and a very good book that I enjoyed very much. Al Capp.
Well, thank you.
A Life to the Contrary. The authors Michael Schumacher and Dennis Kitchen. Thank you both for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much.
Our pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guests, Dennis Kitchen and Michael Schumacher, authors of Al Capp, A Life to the Contrary. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.